Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alpha, the host of Religion Means Alive. And as always, we have some exciting programming for you. Today we happen to have a very distinguished journalist. In fact, we're going to talk about journalism, African-Americans in journalism, and then we're going to talk about some hot-button issues facing African-American America today. I'd like to read the biography of our guest. Journalist and author Les Payne was born July the 12th in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. As a child, Payne was always interested in writing. He graduated from the University of Connecticut in 1964, with a B.A. degree in English. Serving 6 years in the United States Army, Payne worked as an Army journalist and wrote speeches for General William C. Westmoreland. While on assignment in Vietnam, he ran the Army's newspaper, and when he was discharged, he had attained the rank of captain. Payne joined Newsday in the late 1960s, serving as associate managing editor for the paper's National Science and International News. In 1968, as an investigative reporter, Payne covered the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. And in 1970, he covered the Black Panther Party. He won a Pulitzer Prize for the Harlem Trail, in 1974, which was a Newsday series in 33 parts that traced the international flow of heroin from the poppy fields of Turkey to the veins of drug addicts in New York City. Later, it became a published book. He also covered the Seminese Liberation Army and authored the life and death of the Seminese Liberation Army. As a Newsday correspondent, Payne reported extensively from Africa, the Caribbean, and the United Nations. During the 1976 Soweto Uprising, he traveled throughout South Africa and wrote a series that was also nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in Foreign Reporting. Payne is also responsible for Newsday's Queen Edition, whose news staff have won every major award in journalism, including 3 Pulitzer Prizes. He's also a columnist for the Tribune Media Service. As one of the founders and former presidents of the National Association of Black Journalists, Payne has worked to improve media fairness and employment practices. He's also the inaugural professor for the David Leventhal Chair at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Payne has received several awards, including the United Nations World Hunger Media Award and 3 Unity Awards for investigative reporting. In 1990, he won cable television's highest honor, the ACE Award, for an interview with David Dinkins on Les Payne's New York Journal. In addition, he is a recipient of 2 honorary doctorate degrees from Medgar Evers College and Long Island University. Payne resides in Harlem with his wife and children. Welcome, Les Payne, to Religion Means Alive, and we know that one of the great journalists, Chuck Stone, has passed, and I wonder what you reflect upon that and tell us about differentiate. I've got 2 questions here. Differentiate between a journalist and just a regular author.
Yes. Well, thanks for inviting me on, Imam Muhammad. Chuck Stone was an adult. I mean, he obviously was experienced. He grew up in Hartford. He was in Connecticut, which I happened to have escaped to from Alabama when I was 12 years old. He grew up in Hartford. He had worked with Adam Clayton Powell and others, and by the time he was the first black columnist, you know, at the Philadelphia Daily News down in Philly. And I encountered him, began to, I used to run into him when I came to work for Newsday. there was a group of black journalists who we would meet occasionally, either covering the NAACP committee or the Black Power Conference or the Black Leadership Conference out in Gary, Indiana in the early 70s. And we kept meeting, and then finally we came together, a group of us, in Washington in 1975, and we organized then what was called the National Association of Black Journalists, and it's still existing, has about 3,000 or 4,000 members. And Chuck Stone, there were 44 of us who formed the organization, and Chuck Stone was, there was a group of equals, but he was the, he was first among the equals. He was kind of one of the few adults in the room. I don't claim to have been an adult. I was a young reporter, you know, eager to get things. I wanted to see some head snapping as opposed to organization. But it was Chuck Stone. He had the, you know, in the old days when I was a reporter, if you go to an assignment, you always look for the man who had or the woman who had the clipboard, and usually it was a man. And the person who had the clipboard was the person in charge. Chuck Stone was the one with the clipboard. And while the rest of us were making declarations, we got to get more blacks, we got to kick some heads, we got to charge in and make mainstream media more reasonable, more fair, has to cover the third world. It was Chuck Stone, in addition to that, who said, yes, we need to do all of that, but we also have to have an organization. And it was Chuck who began to talk about things like the bylaws and about a structure. And it was he who made the National Association of Black Journalists a sustainable group. And to that degree, I think he made a major contribution to at least the Organization of Black Journalists. And, of course, his column down at the Philadelphia Inquirer, you know, was very, very courageous. It stood the establishment on its ear. It was erudite. It was informed. It was courageous. In fact, he became a character of great respect because at first there were a couple of people, African Americans in Philly, who were wanted by the police. They were either perpetrators or suspects, and they were, because Philly during that time, you know, was very brutal, one of the most brutal, police brutal states, cities in the country, of which there were many. Milwaukee was another one. They would turn themselves into Chuck Stone, the columnist, and Chuck Stone with the idea that he would turn over to the police. And something like 85 suspects over time would turn themselves into Chuck, which is a great statement as to the credibility that he had, the courage that he had, and the trust that even people on the run or people wanted by the law had in him. And so I think he was a major contributor in terms of journalism.
Tell us, when we speak of journalism, what's the difference between a journalist and a columnist?
Well, a columnist, I can't improve on what A.J. Liebling said, and Liebling described it. He says there are three types of in the newspaper business, which is what he was talking about. He said there were three kinds of writers. He said the first writer is a reporter. He said the reporter writes what he sees. And he said then there is the interpretive writer. He says the interpretive writer writes what he sees and what he construes to be its meaning. And then he said there is the expert. And he said the expert writes what he construes to be the meaning of what he has not seen. And he went on to say that the expert, and the columnist, by the way, would be the expert. This is a person who can write about what he proves to be the meaning of what he has not seen, whereas a reporter writes what he sees and does not put his opinion or her opinion into it, whereas the expert writes what he construes to be the meaning of what he has not seen. And Liebling went on to say that the reporter, as one example, if he's covering the war, then he can cover only the war. If he's in the war zone, he's covering the war. He said, but the expert, the reporter cannot cover the war zone and, say, the Pentagon at the same time. But he said the expert can, and usually he can do it from an office in New York. So I think it is the reporter who is on the scene, who is listening, who is taking notes, who is taking observation, and I think it is that person who leaves his or her opinion out of it and writes what the facts are and get as close to the truth as he can with the accumulation of facts that he can gather.
Okay. So, in other words, I've had an occasion to observe a very outstanding journalist in the newsroom, and I've watched the process. That stories just can't come out of the paper unless you have, you have to have facts, right? I mean, you have to,
well,
you know,
no.
As an editor, what is, you, some people, the general public may think an editor is someone just edits and put the commas in the right, but tell us first also about stories, and tell us also about how, what an editor does, an editor.
Yeah, well, the reporter is the eyes and the ears of the, if it's a newspaper, which is what I knew for and worked in for 38 years, is eyes and the ears and the feet. Yeah, he's a person who goes out on the street, climbs the stairs, walk down the tunnel, goes on the ship, witness the war, if it's the war that he or she is covering. He is the eyes and the ears of the paper. When he writes what he has gathered from out there, he takes it and writes it and then passes on his account of it to the editor. And the editor is a person who reads it and makes corrections on the one hand, grammatically, make sure that the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, the verbs agree, and also make sure that there are not inconsistencies, and also make sure that the story is balanced. In other words, you can't just have one side of the story. You have to make sure that it is fair, because one of the journalism at its best, when it is working, when it is proper, when it is good, it has to be balanced, it has to be fair, which is to say you just can't tell one side of the story. So the editor makes sure that the reporter has gathered, you know, both sides of the story. For instance, one of the great mistakes that used to be made when I got into journalism, and I found it to an appalling degree, is that a lot of these stories in newspapers simply told the police version of a story. Police said, and that was enough. And what I would always insist is, no, we don't want to simply know what the police said. We want to go out and we need to talk to eyewitnesses. We need to talk to the woman or the man who was on the second floor looking out, and what did he or she see? Was the so-called perpetrator beaten? Was the person armed? Was he not armed? And so a lot of these stories, in fact, my whole experience in journalism has been about balancing the other side, and that is what a responsible editor would do.
Okay, I very classic work. I believe you also have served as a juror on the Pulitzer Prize board. Can you share with us what does that mean, and tell us what the Pulitzer Prize?
Well, yeah, several times. At least twice. What the Pulitzer is the highest prize that the so-called industry of journalism gives to reporters, and what happens is that newspapers from all over the country, in terms of journalism, of course, there are Pulitzers that are also given for people who write books. But in terms of journalism, newspapers submit their stories, and usually their top stories, and they write, you know, thousands and thousands of stories during the course of a year. At the end of the year, they select usually the best story in a given category, whether it is science reporting, whether it is news reporting, whether it is commentary, whether it is column writing, whether it is a local story, whether it's a national story, whether it's a foreign story, and they select the best of story of all of those, and they submit them. And what the Pulitzer Board usually, and they separate them into various categories. There are those categories that I mentioned. For instance, let's say it's a national story or a New York City story. And then each of those areas would have a panel of anywhere from usually four or five jurors. You know, and these jurors are usually editors drawn from around the country. They will sit down, and if there are, say, 150 newspapers have submitted stories, they judge among those 150 best stories what they take to be the best five stories, and then they give a Pulitzer to one story. Not unlike what happens, I suppose, with the Oscars, although I've never been on an Oscar nomination or the Academy Award, but it's a similar process.
Now, you have interviewed several national, international figures. I want you to share with us some of those international figures. We are listening to Les Payne, in my opinion, informed opinion, I must tell you, is the dean of journalists, one of the deans of African American journalists, but also the dean of journalism. Now, that's my term. He may disagree with me. I was in the edit, and he's in the editing room. That may get swatted down, but I do know that because I know a thing or two. Have worked at Muhammad Speak. Know a little bit about the newspaper business, only a little bit. So I just want you to share with some of the people you have interviewed. I believe you have interviewed and covered Nelson Mandela, and you have covered.
Yes.
Just tell us some of the people you have covered.
Well, yeah, I was at that. Happened to have spoken just Monday night at the Harvard Club, but they were celebrating Nelson Mandela's passing. And one of the things that they were celebrating was that in 1998, he was given an honorary degree by Harvard. He was still president. It was the last year of his presidency. And interestingly enough, I don't know if people remember this, but Harvard had, they convened a special, what they call a convocation. And they had only done that three times. This was the third time in the history of Harvard they had ever done this. They convened a special convocation, gave an honorary degree simply for him, let him speak. No one else, wasn't a graduating class or anything. And they had only done it twice previously. And the two previous times they had done it was for George Washington and for Winston Churchill. And the third one was Nelson Mandela, and he took special note of that. But having said that, so we discussed, you know, not just the speech, but, you know, the meaning of Nelson Mandela's incarceration, his liberation, his presidency, his contribution to South Africa and elsewhere. So, yes, I had the great privilege of interviewing Nelson Mandela the week he was released from prison back in 1990. And in terms of some of the other African leaders, and I've just been astounded by some of the insights. In South Africa, I had the great privilege of interviewing Robert Mangaliso Sobukwe, who was the head of the PAC. He was the opposite number for Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela was the ANC. He was the PAC. And he was banned when I saw him, and I snuck away and saw him. Some of the others I've been privileged to interview was Julius Nyerere. You know, when Julius Nyerere was then the president of Tanzania, he had sent in 40,000 troops into Uganda to chase out Idi Amin. I've interviewed Sekou Touré when he was the president of Guinea. And when he was the president of Guinea, you know, he was, as president, he threw the French out. And the French and Europe retaliated on him, you know, tremendously. But you know, he threw them out. So those were people that I've been. Some of the foreign. I interviewed Robert Mugabe when Robert Mugabe was fighting with ZANU out of Mozambique. I interviewed him in the bush of Mozambique before he became president. He and Joshua Nkoma was also fighting there. So I fought them when they were guerrilla leaders. And again, you know, from Bernard, Manley, Jamaica. I remember when he was a prime minister of Jamaica, interviewing him, you know, when he was prime minister and after, of Grenada, Maurice Bishop, you know, who was a very intelligent, bright, perceptive person. Maurice Bishop, I interviewed him, spent hours with him, you know, and you know, in terms of this country, you know, I've interviewed, you know, presidents, and by the way, when I was I've also interviewed Imam Wallace Muhammad. You might be interested to know out in Chicago. So I was privileged to spend a hour and a half with him.
Now, I must tell our audience the best stories that ever been done on him. A late reporter under your supervision, Elaine Rivera, did a two-part series on our community. And I remember the headline blaring, Farrakhan's Nemesis, and it contrasts Imam Muhammad. Wonderful. I want to move right along to, we're listening to Les Payne, the journalist, former managing editor at Newsday. And you can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. I know some of you are chomping at the bit for other questions, but I want to set this up properly. You've also interviewed the president. You have interviewed President Obama. One day I called you, and I think you had been at the White House. You have interviewed Valerie Jarrett, President William Jefferson Clinton. I don't know what George Bush, but you've interviewed several people. I want to now ask you about a local story that appeared in Newsday some, maybe, if my memory serves me correct, maybe 30-some years ago, your newspaper was responsible for doing an in-depth story on Tawana Brawley. Can you recall that story and how that story came about? Did you have any
detail? Yes, I just, not to go, I won't go into detail, but I'll go as far as you want to go on that one. I mean,
I'd like to go on because I think it's very important that that story be clear. I just wanted to know, first of all, the reason I'm doing that, I'm telling the audience something, give you a heads up. I'm not a lawyer, but I did get an opportunity to study with some great lawyers. They say, y'all be asked questions for probative purpose. You know, that stupid question. I don't believe in that. Mm-hmm. I don't have any opinion on any of this. I only deal with facts, private, at least anyway. But I wanted to know that because I think it's very important that you're threading truth out. I mean, you know, I mean, you don't deal with opinions. You deal with facts. And you have
and if I deal with opinion, I'll let you know this is what I think. I could certainly be willing to draw a distinction. But, yeah, no, we covered that story. I supervised a five-person team who covered that story for a month and a half. I mean, 7 months. And then I came out of retirement as a reporter and worked on it. So I know the ups and downs, the inside and outs of that story, any angles you want to know.
But so this young lady was raped, and Reverend Alfred C. Shopton and C. Vernon Mason, attorney, and Alton Maddox, and Collins Moore, the Reverend Herbert Daughtry, and others were involved, and it was a hot story. Wasn't it a pitiful situation, or what should the public know about that story? Because people brought up that.
Well, I'm sure it's been hashed, and I'm sure your listeners are sophisticated, those who were watching it, and would you say those of my generation and your generation would certainly have their views and remember how it was covered. The younger generation may have some questions about it. But it was a very hot story. There was a newspaper war going on. She claimed that she was 15 years old. She claimed she had been raped. She was missing for 4 days over the Thanksgiving holiday in 1987. She reappeared, said that she was in the hospital, you know, with the N-word written on her chest. Her hair had been pulled out, or at least her extensions had been pulled out, and she was in a bag, and so there was a lot of mystery because she wouldn't tell anything beyond to say that she had been raped by white men over a period of days. And called in Sharpton, the activist, and two lawyers, young lawyers, brilliant lawyers at that point, C. Vernon Mason and Alton Maddox. And they worked that case in the public arena, very controversial and inconclusive. The grand jury concluded that she had not, in fact, been raped. The two lawyers and Sharpton insisted that she had been.
That was another story circulating. You had occasion, you have known Reverend Shopton. I don't know whether you covered him, but certainly your reporters have covered him.
Mm-hmm.
You did a series on that. Have you, do you know C. Vernon, now I guess he's Reverend C. Vernon Mason, but formerly C. Vernon Mason.
No.
Attorney C. Vernon Mason, and Reverend, and please forgive me, I'm getting ready to call him Reverend again. He's the son of a preacher. That is Alton Maddox.
Yeah. I have met them. I know some better than others. And again, I know them professionally.
Or at least there's a rumor that you, in fact, warned those fellas.
Well, here's the story on that. Around the time of 1988, this Sharpton had already, he was building a reputation at that point. The story got a lot of press coverage, going from around Thanksgiving of 87 through 1988. Newsday in that year of January came out, and wrote a story saying that essentially that, Reverend Sharpton, back in 83 at that point, had, worked for, and was in fact at that point working for the FBI. That Reverend Sharpton in 1983, he was associated with boxing promoter Don King, and he was entrapped, my word, by an FBI agent who was posing. He had a sting operation going, and he was posing as someone who wanted to get in the fight game. And Sharpton, who was on this meeting with Don King, and later shopped in alone with this FBI informant who was undercover. His name was Quintinelli, as I recall it. And so he and Shopton, he taped and videotaped a conversation he had with Shopton involving drugs, in which he made a drug offer. Shopton kind of was agreeing and going along with it, the purchase of a cocaine deal. And they showed him, Shopton, the video, and told him that he was in deep trouble and that they were going to prosecute him. The FBI did, unless he worked for them, and he agreed to work for them. So the real deal, no matter what you hear, is that he was, in fact, flipped by the FBI because they threatened to prosecute him. And so he agreed during a course of a number of years, starting in 1988, he did a number of jobs. Wasn't just one job. It wasn't just people who were targets of FBI and government, federal government investigation from the Eastern District. Shopton, you know, he wasn't their main guy. Obviously, they have many sources. He was just one informant, but he was, in fact, an informant who was working with the FBI on target, on people who had been targeted by the federal government. Some of these people were mafia connected people. Some of them were black leaders. Some of them were elected officials. Some of them were in core. And we, Newsday, broke the story on and made that disclosure. And interestingly enough, interviewed Shopton before the story broke. They sat down with Reverend Shopton for 2 hours, and went over the information that they had and got him, because they had the goods on him, got him to admit that that he had informed on Major Owens, congressman, that he had Sonny Carson was another name that came up. Other black activists and politicians were floated about. And he, because he couldn't deny it at that point during this closed meeting, so Newsday wrote the story. This was in, I think, January of 1988. And they wrote the story. And when the story appeared, he denied it to the black community, because this is the height of the tone of us, and they, oh, it's all a lie. And so what Newsday did cleverly, Don Forrest, the editor whom you know, who was the editor of New York Newsday, they ran the entire transcript verbatim of a two-hour interview that they had with Shopton. They ran it in the newspaper, verbatim. And still he was saying that it was a lie. And true, and there were incredibly, there were people, some in the black community, who were asking me that, that's a lie, isn't it? I said, do you think I would work for a newspaper, even though I had nothing to do with putting the story together? I said, do you think I would work for a newspaper that would make up a 2.5-hour interview and run it? You know, this is not the New York Post. It's not even the Daily News. This is a credible newspaper. Newsday didn't have that kind of a reputation. And so what I did, though, because I knew that there would be black leaders who, if a black leader had not been targeted by the FBI, then he wasn't of particular interest. And what, during the course of the developments, it turned out that, A, he would walk around with an attaché case, had a microphone in it, and he would record conversation unbeknownst to the people whose conversation he was taping. And B, he agreed, and he told Newsday during the conversation that the FBI had installed a phone in his Brooklyn home that people could call, that the FBI had taped this telephone, and he had allowed them, think about this, to install it in his home. Now, at this time, and he was still under the influence and control of, this is in 88, of the Eastern District, and Al D'Amato and the Republicans and others. And so so I said, because there were people that I knew, I said, look, let me, because people read the newspapers and they'll say, and Shopton will say, oh, that's just white folks telling lies once again. You know how they are. And so I called, I was at, and I never forget it, I was, in fact, I had lunch with Randy the other day. I was at Randy Daniels' house. And so I was at Randy Daniels' house. C. Vernon Mason, the attorney, was there present. I told
tell
him
our audience, who is Randy Daniels, and also tell.
Well, Randy Daniels was the Secretary of State for 6 years, you know, up until about 4 years ago. So he was the New York Secretary of State. Back at that point, he was a businessman, politician, you know, but not an elected official. You know, he was a staff worker for various politicians, and he later became, under the Pataki administration, the Secretary of State.
He had been originally trained as a journalist. I'm setting the stage for this because
he started out as a journalist. Randy, when he was working for CBS, he worked for CBS. He's from Chicago, and he worked for CBS for 10 years. In fact, I met him when we were both covering the guerrilla war in Rhodesia, which became Zimbabwe. In fact, he was a Nairobi bureau chief for CBS, which is where I knew him. And he's a buddy. He's a longtime buddy of mine from his days as a journalist.
But he later went into politics. We want you to know he's the one that broke the national story that Imam Wartha Dean Muhammad, at that time Minister Wallace D. Muhammad, would be the leader of the Nation of Islam. It proved to be true. It was broken somewhere in February 16th, early January, I believe, and 1975. I just wanted the audience to know.
That was Randy Daniels, yes.
That was Randy Daniels. So, Randy right. Daniels, you were told C. Vernon Mason and attorney Maddox, both these men were admitted.
I told C. Vernon Mason, who was there, he called Alton Maddox on the phone, and also Reverend Calvin Butts was there present. And I told them all, A, the story is true, and what is truth about is that this man is working for the FBI, that he is in touch with them, and that he had this phone in his house, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And the clear warning, I didn't tell them, it was on their own, is that to stay away from him, you know. But they didn't believe it at that point. Now, 26 years later, Maddox is convinced, you know, that the story is true. But the problem is, I mean, this is way, way late, you know, because, now the analysis part, the interpretive part, I mean, what I've just said until now is facts. But I think the thing that gets me is that, you know, we have Reverend Sharpton, and I have no vested interest in here. I have no malice against him, but I do have an interest, which is why I got into journalism. I have an interest for the black community getting the facts. And the facts are not as he presents them. He presents them that this recent round of stories, which I think, you know, don't concern me a great deal, because the fact that he did that against the mafia, you know, is one thing. But what concerns me is the work that he was doing against the African-American community. And think about it. You can't snitch on people that you are not associated with. He wasn't associated with the mafia. You snitch on the people that you are, in fact, associated with. And I think that what happens is that the joke, really, you know, looking at this recent coverage in the Daily News and the Post with him on the front cover and working for the mafia, I mean, the deal is not that simply that he was threatened by the mafia and he went to the mafia, to the FBI to protect him. That is not what happened. What happened is that he was threatened to be prosecuted by the FBI, and he worked with the FBI. And he worked with them on targets of FBI investigations.
Isn't that a classic way that they generally flip people, they bring charges or may not bring charges, threaten to bring charges, and then those persons are used? Now, Reverend Sharpton has opined that he is Reverend Cat. He also opines that he really, let me just ask you about this one. There is some people in the Black Liberation Army groups, or the Black, well, for lack of a better word, Black National Group, argues that Reverend Sharpton invited them to an apartment in Lincoln Center, again with the briefcase, and also that he had some money in that briefcase for one of the African-American fugitives. So, I don't know.
Well, Ron Howell broke that story, and Howell broke that story for Newsday in 1988.
Your supervision at that time, isn't that correct?
He was not under my supervision, but, you know, Ron, I knew him. You know, we'd worked on occasion. He did that story in New York, but I had previously, I had sent Ron as the foreign editor or the assistant manager editor for the foreign desk. I'd sent him to Cuba, and he had, in fact, interviewed Asada Shakur, is the name of the person, Asada Shakur, who was convicted of being involved in a police killing on the New Jersey Turnpike. She had escaped. she was busted out of prison, and she had escaped to Cuba. She fled to Cuba. And this, the story that Ron Howell broke at that point in 1988 was that Sharpton had gone to Kwame Brathwaite, you know, who was Alumbe's brother, a photographer and a credible guy, and said that he would like to make contact with Asada Shakur. At that point, 83 or so, they didn't know where she was. And so he put him in contact with Ahmed Obafemi, you know, who was more of an activist. And the story Sharpton told was that he was in touch with two Black Panthers, and these Black Panthers wanted to get in touch with Asada Shakur, wherever she was, fugitive from quote-unquote justice for a police killing, and that he wanted to get in touch with her, and that he also wanted to pass along what Kwame remembers as $50,000, and so he wanted to set this in motion if he could. So he used his good offices to get in touch with Ahmed Obafemi, and then they began to smell a rat. One of the, you know, they were interviewed, or he supposedly had the briefcase in the same apartment that Quintanilla had run, was working for, still, you know, as an FBI undercover agent. And so all of that checked out. Ron wrote that story. And so it squares with the reality that he was working with the FBI to those people who had been targeted by the FBI. Now, the FBI that Ron talked to, and Ron got to know this source very well, a reliable FBI source, you know, who said that, yes, this was, in other words, this was not their major, this was not the major way they were trying to get us on the
court. Can I interrupt you a moment and ask the question? In the field of journalism, you all rely heavily on sources. And if, once you develop a source, I mean, you have sources in the FBI, you have sources, as you were telling about Ron. Tell us a little bit about sources, and then I want you to continue on with what we were talking about, Ron Howell, and that information that he passed on, that he wrote
about. Yeah, we rely on sources, but we rely, and with those sources, the information that we get from sources have to be checked out. In this particular case, well, before the particular case, what happens is that we had a reporter who was reporting on, in this case, he was reporting on Don King. While reporting on Don King, the boxing promoter, he finds out that Don King had been in a meeting with the mafia. And in this meeting with the mafia was this Quintanilla, who was an FBI undercover guy, posing as someone who wanted to get in the boxing business. And Sharpton was in one of those meetings, and that's how he was picked up. And so we had, I mean, that was, we had to, before running that story, you have to verify that. You can't just take the word of the FBI source who said that. Because when we got all of that, when the news, they got all of that information together, keep in mind, they sat down for 2 hours with Sharpton and went over this information. And he and then the next day he denied what he had told us the night before.
Well, is it possible that Reverend Sharpton in that big briefcase had some oils and ministerial robes, and he just wanted to make sure that he could minister to people rather than being an informant? He said his argument is that he was a cat.
No, he admitted that he had it. He'll tell you that he had it. But he'll tell you he had it for the mafia. He won't tell you that he had it to find Asada Shakur, because this would really make him the snitch that he was, you see. I mean, his spin on it, and he's a master of spinning, he didn't have $50,000 he didn't say he had $50,000 in the attaché case, but the attaché case, and he had, by the way, the attaché case when he came to Newsday, the attaché case that had an electronic surveillance device in it. That's what the attaché case had. But in addition to the electronic surveillance attaché case, he also had a phone that the FBI had tapped in his house. So if you called him, as we are talking here now, the FBI would be listening in.
And also, can you share with us the Canatel program? And I don't know whether there's any connection, and that's immaterial whether there's connection. But has there been a Canatel program? And tell us, our audience, what that is and whether Reverend, well, let's just continue with that. Describe for us, some of our people may not remember or know what that program was, the counter-tell program.
Well, the counterintelligence program of the FBI, which is a COINTEL program, was a program that was directed at radicals and so-called militants, and it had a heavy emphasis on African Americans. And one of the ideas, I mean, they wanted to prevent the rise of what they said would be a black messiah, someone who could lead black people out of the oppression or perceived oppression that we have been in, you know, since slavery. They definitely would target King, they would target Malcolm, they would target the Black Panthers and Angela Davis and a lot of the African American leaders were targeted, and the whole idea was to destabilize black leadership. And this has been this was particularly the idea, and the role of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover was to keep the black community from becoming enlightened politically and economically by removing leadership, making sure that they did not have sufficient leadership. In other words, as long as you had leadership that was uninformed, corrupt, bought off, who were willing to work as snitches and call themselves civil rights leaders, who had a price, then that was okay. But they wanted to prevent a rise of what they call a black messiah, which is, say, an authentic black leader who had all the six qualities that leaders of oppressed people must have.
Now, there's an argument going around that Reverend Sharpton's, I don't know whether it's purported by him or not, but it's that he's basically, his job is he's been watching out for criminals. Now, some has also made a very strong argument, I would say, that Reverend Sharpton's idea was not to monitor criminals, but two people appeared in the Eastern District that had been in Reverend Sharpton's company that was charged with federal crimes, and they ended up in jail. I don't know if there's any connection between the two. But I also know that it's been rumored that Reverend Sharpton is a destabilizer. So if those people are saying that he's a destabilizer of black leadership, are they off, or are they just talking out of the user street expression, are they talking out of the side of their neck?
Well, again, this is getting into the, I mean, I wouldn't call him a destabilizer per se. It's the FBI who is a destabilizer. And what they use, every FBI informant have somewhere between, 100 and 1,500 informers that he worked with. You know, and anyone who will work for them. In other words, sometimes you don't even, people will, in other words, Sharpton, the facts will show, the record has established, was working for them because he did not want to be indicted for what was on that tape. All right? And so he was working for them, giving them information that was useful to them. And now what they were doing with it, how important it was to them, you know, he may not have known. So, I mean, we cannot say that he set out to destabilize. But I think that if you look at from the other side of it, Imam Muhammad, from the other side, this is less pain speaking here. It seemed to me that there are leaders, and I think Martin Luther King was a legitimate African American leader in the sense that he had those qualities, you know, of intelligence, judgment, courage, independence. He was selfless, and he was ethical. And I think that I think that if you had come to him, if the FBI had come to him, I mean, he wouldn't have, because he was selfless in the sense that he put the interests of the group above his own interests, and he was ethical in the sense that he didn't have a price that you could buy him off in terms of betraying people for dollars. And there are other people who are for money. Some are attracted for money, some are attracted to save their own skin. So I think that I wouldn't call him a destabilizer. I think he was a person who got caught up in a scam by the FBI, an entrapment really by the FBI, and they flipped him. And he worked for them. And he worked for them, and he gave them information that they were interested in. Some of them were you know, come on, how much information can he give them on the mafia? Not much. He doesn't know much. How much can he give them on African American? A lot, because he had our confidence. You know, he was leading rallies. He was the inside of the Brawley case. He was in the heart of the Brooklyn leadership. He knew all of those people. So if any of them were targeted, Major Owens or whoever was targeted by some probe, some government probe, and they wanted some information, he's the guy. He's one of the guys, others as well. You know, look, they were all over Malcolm and King and, you know, with spies, and this was just one of the way one of the guys
said was honeycomb with Seth Person and with Wildcat. I want to ask you another question concerning, this is wonderful, and you all can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. I don't like to be like some talk show host. They get on the program and all they do is talk. They don't let people talk. So I don't want to be guilty of that. I want to open up the phone lines. I think someone has a question. 347-608, you had a question for Les Payne.
Hello, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
Yeah, this is Brother Thabit, and I just wanted to say, you know, when the brother was talking about Sister Shakur, I think also that, I can't remember them, but I believe that that was Tupac's mother, Tupac Shakur. But meantime, you know, I've been into a lot of journalism myself, and I haven't, of course, I don't have that background that you have, Brother Payne, but I do all my work and development in institutions. And when I came home, I wanted to write, and I've been writing ever since, and I've been blessed. Because I worked with William Kunstler when he was trying to do, when they was trying to bring Malcolm's case back, and he was Mike Wallace. I worked with him. I worked with, I worked down at City Hall a number of times, about 5 or 6 times. And I've been very fortunate, and I'm still, you know, I was working for the New Alliance Party, and they, I could never blend with I guess being Muslim and having that other kind of thinking. I could never really blend with some other papers. So they would send me out on bicycle races and stuff like that, and I wanted to get involved in community work. And so eventually, I just wound up doing my own stuff. I'm still doing my own magazine today. It's work. It's expensive. You know, I'm having a hard time with it. Sometimes I get asked, sometimes I don't. But I just feel that this is me. And every time I try to put it down, you know, I put the pen down in one hand and it'll jump up another one. So I can't, I definitely can't give it up. And I want to make about a month or so, I want to do a turnaround, go back into the community and do things that's happening in the Muslim community and other communities, but the Muslim community in particular. And I think this is a very good time now. That spirit is coming back up in there. So
absolutely.
Another thing, I really appreciate talking to you. I hope somewhere along the line we'll run into each other. And
absolutely. What's the name of your magazine?
Well, it's Impact. It's a very small,
very all right,
little community show.
Sure.
But
okay,
I'm working on it. And I hope to, I'll get it together. I changed your name 100 times because
time
don't go over so far.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll hook up down the line through I'm in touch with Mr. Mohammed here all the time.
Yes, sir. All right, brother.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. We have another caller from area code. You can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. 805-727-7013. Caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to ask about Reverend Sharpton's actions as a civil rights pimp, poverty pimp. It seems as if I remember him using the whole civil rights struggle as a stepping stone for something that he never quite delivered on. I know that there were situations that he was considered our spokesperson by many people, and he really didn't articulate the kind of problems and the kind of service that we needed to move forward. And I was always suspicious of whether he was, in fact, an honest to God, a serious person about this civil rights thing, civil rights like so many others have done. Could you make some comments about that if you know anything about that?
Well, I would say, again, I don't know about your situation, and I certainly don't have a generalized critique of him, but one of the things that I have observed over the years is that I think that Reverend Sharpton, in terms of methodology, I think he takes his pattern more from Reverend Jesse Jackson, say, than he does from Martin Luther King. And Reverend Jackson, you know, was the kind of person that I observed. I'll give you but one example. Early in Reverend Jackson's career, he would go out and protest the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley, and then he would go in the side door, journalists and people from inside would tell me, and cut a deal with the Daley administration without telling the people he was protesting with what the deal was. And that was also an example in which they were protesting. I remember Quaker Oats, and I remember talking to him about this in the early 70s on a show down in Philadelphia called Black Perspective on the News, in which he led a protest against Quaker Oats. And yet he went and cut a deal with Quaker Oats without telling the people, African Americans, what that deal was. And I questioned him about it, and it was almost as if we had no right to know. I said, well, but you're protesting in the name of those people. So I think that the pattern tended to be that the African American community would have a legitimate grief, and whatever it was, whether it was Michael Stewart or whether it was Tawana Brawley or whether it was Quaker Oats discriminating against them, and they would voice some outrage, and the leader, civil rights leader, quote unquote, would come and absorb that community rage from the African American community would lead the march, absorb that energy, and then go in and cut a deal with them and make that problem go away. Whether it's George Steinbrenner at Yankee Stadium, whether it's Barney's, and then they would demonstrate and demonstrate, then the energy would dissipate, and somewhere along the line, money has exchanged hands, a deal has been cut. So that is a pattern which I think is a little bit deceptive. But I think at bottom it goes to the question of whether or not someone has a price, because if they have a price, they can be bought off.
And one other thing, if I can ask, that transcript of the conversation with Newsday, is that available on the web?
Well, I don't know about the web, but Newsday ran, you can call it a Newsday library, they ran that entire transcript in the paper. It was available to the public in the paper, the entire 2 hours that he talked. And he talked to them, said things on that tape about Major Owens and other, and then the next day denied it. And so Newsday ran a transcript, and then he denied that the transcript. And the people saying that, well, they wanted to hear the absolute recording. I said, do you think I would work for a paper that would make up these pages and pages of conversation? You know, so, but you could call Newsday Library, and I'm sure they would have it. You know, because it may not be online. Because this was in 1988.
All right, thank you.
Sure.
Caller, yes, why hasn't the African-American press dealt with that? It just seems that, you know, I'm not here to pick on Reverend Sharpton. I'm here to really just find information. That's what this program is set up for the purpose of bringing out information about what's going on in the African American community. In fact, we're interested in what's going on in the African American community from Rio de Janeiro all the way up to Halifax, Nova Scotia, in particular, and then crossing overseas and seeing what's going on in Africa. But it's a particular interest now that we had Reverend Sharpton, who has become, in a sense, the premier spokesperson for African America. I don't know by default or by whatever, but that has been the case. Tell me, what's the role? I've heard this term, and I don't know quite what I know what it means or not, speaking truth to power. What does that mean as a journalist? But I'm not even concerned about...
Well, I don't know about speaking truth to power, but you know, as I said earlier, and, you know, when you were querying me about journalism, I mean, I think what we do is we get out and ferret out the facts, you know, we verify those facts. We make sure they're relevant. We make sure they're not libelous. We make sure that they don't violate propriety. We make sure that the person who is a subject of those, if they are charges, get a shot to explain himself, either say no comment or to deny them, you know, as Sharpton did in this particular case. And as far as the role of the black press, I mean, I consider I'm black and I'm a part of the black press ipso facto, you know, and I think that the role of the press, of the press is to inform the black community and everyone else. But one of the negligent aspects of the press is that our people, in other words, they'll like, you know, those three stories, the hammering about the mafia. You know, I don't really care a great deal about the mafia, but I do, in fact, care a great deal that the black community not be deceived by what Sharpton says that his role was with the FBI vis-a-vis the African-American community. You see, that's my concern now, and I think that that's why I got into journalism. Simply, I have no malice, no personal interest in this, but I do think that the black community should be informed. And so I think that in this particular case, the role of the press is to say what the facts are. And the facts are, and therefore, when they are denied, you know, and people, you know, like Maddox all these years later now is saying that, I think he's come to the realization that this person whom he trusted and worked with was deceiving him. For instance, if, let's look at it this way, Mohammed. Sharpton now says, because he can twist it, yes, I worked with the FBI. Yes, I had an attaché case with an electronic listening device in it, but I only did it because they were interested in the mafia. Okay, he admit to that. Okay, why didn't he admit back in 1983 and 1988 to the people that he was leading on those marches that, oh, by the way, I have this, I'm working with the FBI. I carry this electronic listening device around with me, and I have this phone that is tapped. Knowingly, they told me that a stamp is in my house, and I'm working with the FBI. Did he tell the African-American community that? Did he tell Mason that when on the Brawley case? Did he tell Sharpton? Did he tell Reverend Mitchell? Did he tell Reverend Butts? Did he tell Leonard Jeffries? Did he tell all of Brooklyn, black Brooklyn, that that's what he was doing? I don't think so.
Yes, and that is called informed consent. We have a caller from 908-463. You're on the air with Religion Means Alive. And before the caller asks the question, you can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. 805-727-7013. We're speaking with Les Payne, the dean of journalism.
I'm calling because I needed to know why he hasn't been exposed in the black media. I mean, just like you know this, other black people know this, other black a journalist know this, and I just was wondering why he hasn't been exposed in black press, in the Amsterdam News, in the I guess the Chicago Defender, and all the other black. We still have black press. Why this isn't put out there so that we can, when we see him, we can defend ourselves. We can at least know that he's coming. And you know what? Another thing I want to say when he exposes these politicians, right? That does something to us as a people. That completely disappoints us. That completely ruins the way we think about our own people. So I wonder why he hasn't been exposed in the black press, not waiting for the white press to expose him. Can you just tell us that? Tell me that, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
Well, you would have to ask, you know, the black press. I mean, ask Eleanor Tatum, you know, who said that this information, even about the mafia, was irrelevant and old news. I mean, I don't know where they're coming from. I know some of these people, but I don't know why the Chicago Defender, well, New York, I mean, he's a New York guy. I know that when this happened back then, by the way, when Newsday wrote these stories, okay, and about the Tawana Brawl and all this stuff. I mean, I know I certainly made myself available to everybody back then as I am today. I mean, I remember going on WWRL, WLIB. I remember going on with Kate Thompson Payne, you know, and for two days in a row, talking about the Brawley case. So, I mean, I think that, and black people listening to some of those black radio stations. So, but I think that there is, I think that Sharpton has the Svengali ability to con, or I won't say con, I'll say gain the confidence and the trust, apparently, because, you know, he make you not believe your lying eyes and your ears. And so I think that, for instance, everybody said, well, this is old news. Well, it is not old news, because I think that the thing about him that people just need to know is that, for instance, the Village Voice did, when he ran for president, you know, in fact, one of the reasons he ran for senator, when he ran for senator, was to drain. He was supported by the Republican. He ran as a Democrat. He was supported by Republicans like D'Amato and others to drain black votes away from Bobby Abrams. When he ran for president in 2000, and he ran for president, and this is not all that long ago, it's 2004. He ran for president. He got all the way to South Carolina. And it so happens that the person who was supplying a lot of his money, as written by Wayne Barrett and who proved it in the Village Voice, was with Roger Stone. And who is Roger Stone? Roger Stone is the Republican Party dirty trickster. So his so-called Republican run for the presidency, Sharpton's, was really supported, financed heavily by the Republicans. He didn't tell us that. So that is a deception. So here's a guy that, in a Svengali kind of way, you know, has subverted, I won't use the word con, because I don't like the word con in this context, but he certainly has taken advantage of, in my view, I think the records show that he has exploited his relationship with, as a quote-unquote leader, with black community, to his own advantagement, again. It's like when he would go in and to Barney's or to whoever and take the problem, and he would take it and then absorb the person who is making the offense against the black community for some kind of payday. And I'll give you, like, we, the National Association of Black Journalists, was up against him at one point with Don Imus. You remember Don Imus, Imam Muhammad?
Yes, sir. I certainly do. All the ugly things he said about us. Yes, sir.
That's right. And what happened is this last episode was with when he called those the players over in New Jersey. You know what they called? I won't even repeat it. You know, nappy headed. I won't go beyond that. And at that point, when he got in trouble, finally, I had been writing about Don Imus for 15 years at that point, talking about his racism. And I alone, Clarence Page and others going on his show, you know, Maureen Dowd, Dan Rather, all of these people, press people, were going on Imus' show, and I was hammering him, you know, for a dozen years about his racism. So finally he makes this comment, and so when he gets in trouble, and this is the way it works, and think about this now, and this is serious. I mean, I'm not trying to, there's no malice on my part. I mean, Chopped and I have a professional relationship. You know, I've had interviews with him for hours at a time. But what happens is that Don Imus was in trouble with the black community. So what is his first instinct? His first instinct is to go on Sharpton's show, or have Sharpton come on show, and have him discuss his sorrow, the fact that he's sorry. He would be absorbed, and then there would be some kind of pay exchange, and then the problem would go away. But what happened this time is that the National Association of Black Journalists, the organization that I and Chuck Stone formed, you know, back in 1975, we got involved. And we went to Imus' advertisers, and we took that initiative out of the hands of Sharpton. And what I would argue is that that's what elements of the black community has to do at every stage, is to not let him be your mouthpiece. Because he's clearly shown, and the record shows, that he cannot be trusted. Hello.
I had you on. Mute. I had myself on mute. A caller just sent me a text, and his text was, let me read it. I want to be precise. He says, "A cat masquerading as a rat. So does this mean that that role as a rat is not over?
Well, if we have to go to the animal world for the metaphor, I think it would more appropriately be snake.
Mm-hmm. Hey, can you explain to us why you use that term? I mean, you're a careful wordsmith, Pulitzer Prize author, and I think you also have a background in investigative journalism. So for you to use that terminology, why is that
Well, because, I mean, it's in the bush. It's a person who moves with stealth and with great deception, spring ambushes. In other words, not telling people that. I mean, a cat is a cat. You know it's a cat is coming. Now, the rat is too bad if the rat doesn't know that he's coming. The rat, if we can ferret him out, but what we're really talking about here is neither one of those characteristics. We're talking about the characteristics as we have been describing over the last, you know, many minutes, is we're talking about the characteristics of someone who has installed in his Brooklyn home a phone that he has agreed to allow the FBI to tap, and he does not tell the people who calls him and people that he calls. This is stealth. It is the snake that moves by stealth. The cat is, you know, can stealth only when he's tracking. So I think it's a slither kind of misdirection that we are talking about here.
We have another caller from 347. Caller, you are on the air with Les Payne. Caller, you are on the air, 347. You on the air with Les Payne. Let me just identify, do a station break right now. You're listening to Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred of Religion Means Alive. And those of you who are listening on browser, you can just join by Facebook. Just dial 805-727-7013. And pose your question. Call at 347-341. Anybody who's still on with us, mute yourself. 347-341. You're on the air with Religion Means a Lot.
Yes, assalamu alaikum, Imam Alfred. Can you hear me?
Walaikum assalam.
Okay, my son wants to speak first. This is Sister Hadia. My son wants
to
speak first, and then I'm going to speak. He's 18, and he has something he wants to say.
Okay, great. Please.
Hello, Brother Alfred. My name is Brother Yassin. I'm 18 years old. I'm Brother Dabit's son. I was just calling to let you know, I thank you for the words of encouragement and advice, especially out here in the Rockaways, because we are indeed hope right now and truly overcoming our problems of what we face in the tactics. And I would like to advise in a little ad that how do you provide for yourself, your community, and others while you still know that the trump card game of the New World Order is still over-existent in this prehistoric time period, and how do we overcome our fears of being over-intimidated without feeling so frightened, enlightenment by what has happened over the years?
Well, you sound like a very wise young man. I'm sure you'll get on. But that's going to probably be, I would better ask you to, I would rather for you ask that question of me probably when a day I have an open forum where I can answer. If any questions you have, please pose them to my guest, Les Payne, editor Newsday, because he is the guest today. I'm not the guest. I do have a guest today. And someone will interview me and ask me questions, and I would answer you. But, young man, you are on your way. I can tell you by having you're a fine young man. I know your father well. So I keep up the good work. Now the next question. Anyone please?
Assalamu alaikum. Imam Alfred, I'd like to speak on Al Sharpton. Now, okay.
Hey, great.
I have a different feeling about this whole situation, okay? I'm back in college. I just recently went back to college after all these years at my age, and I'm taught to, you know, evaluate everything. Now, the fact remains that nobody knew this about Al Sharpton, but at the time that he chose to bring out at the time that the convention was taking place, and this was something that meant a lot to a lot of our, these here white folks, or maybe that's not the right way to say it, but the powers that be chose at this particular time when he was bringing this, putting this convention together, they chose this time to bring that out. I think that needs to be questioned. You know, a lot of folks, our people are jumping on the fact that Al Sharpton is a sellout and all that. Okay, he may very well be. But at the same time, I don't really see too many other brothers picking up the baton, you know, and trying to do some of the things that he's doing. So could you speak on that for me?
Pose the question. I'm not the guest, sister. I don't have any real opinion.
No, I mean to the gentleman that's there. I'm sorry, man.
That's paying the journalists. I don't, you know.
Well, look, you know, my view on this all the time, and again, it's you know, it's for me, it's been 26 years of this. But I mean, I know people like you 26 years ago in real time. He wasn't putting together any convention then, and people still wanted to go. So go merrily along with him.
Mm-hmm.
And good luck.
So you're saying that he's not a voice for our people. His efforts that he's trying to do now by putting people in places in different cities to train them how to teach our people how to vote so that we can have some say-so in the next election. Not that I'm big on that, but you're saying that it's null and void, it's worthless?
Well, I'm saying the larger picture is how black interest is merchandised. You know, and that's a larger issue. Now, can some good come of this? Yeah, I mean, because you have to do good. You know, you, I'm not saying that there's no good that's going on at any level. But what I am saying, though, is that the question of, it seems to me that a leader must have those qualities I tried to enumerate before. And if one of those qualities is that this person is about the Benjamins and is selfish, and lacks the kind of ethics that mean that he's not for sale, then, you know, in those other areas are fine. So I don't, Godspeed, you know, I remember, and I'll say it again, you know, from 26 years ago, Maddox would said, Maddox would say the same thing that you're saying. He's saying they're bringing this up because of Tawana Brawley, and he's in the news, and we're trying to do the Lord's work. He won't say that. He won't say that today. You read what he says now. Reverend Mitchell, 26 years ago, argued me for an hour and a half. You know, he told me, you know, in fact, he went to his church, and he was going to offer an altar prayer for me. You know, I was misled about Sharpton, and he almost lost his church because they had taken over his church in the Brawley case, and he almost lost it because they would, and then accused his daughter of being a snitch for Governor Cuomo, and Reverend Mitchell came to his life. So I'm not trying to bring souls to Christ. I'm not trying to turn people off on Sharpton. I'm simply trying to, my job as a journalist is really to put the facts out. How you respond to those facts is totally up to you.
And
you want to follow him?
This is all what we're doing here at the program. We, you know, Sunday I advocate. Monday through Saturday, we're here to present facts. We're not here to give opinions. We're here to present facts. And to present people to know, and as I said, Les Payne is a journalist, 30 years. I've known him, we have become, I don't never say it, we are friends of journalists, because journalists are journalists. But we have a professional relationship, and I respect him, but I've known him over here. I've never talked with him unless he was talking about facts. So that's what we're interested in. We're interested in facts. We're interested in analysis. And will you tell us where you're going to be Friday, in case somebody wants to come? I'm sure people will want to hear you speak.
Yeah, I'd like to come.
Well, we're going to be at John Henry Clark's house with Simo Tepp and Betty Dobson and Professor McIntyre.
I know
that. At 6:30 at the John Henry Clark's house.
Yeah, Les is not a Johnny come late. Les has been on this for years as a journalist, not only just covering this story, he has covered people, period, leadership, period. And that's what we need. We need a robust, vigorous press so we can be informed. I'm not telling you to support. Frankly, I think you should support Imam Alfred Muhammad. But, hey, if you don't want to support me, that's your business. But you should know if I'm receiving money from somebody, if a journalist finds out I'm receiving $1 million from Saudi Arabia, maybe he should view my politics. You know, if the journalists check out and find out I'm just getting money from you all, then I should be working for you. Thank you, caller, for your question. Thank you, young man, the 18-year-old young man. Thank you, my son. And any rest of you like to ask questions, that's dial 805-727-7013. 805-727-7013. Please ask questions of Les Payne. I'm not the guest today. But Les Payne is the guest. I do want to ask you a question that's somewhat unrelated. And that is a question, another question that needs to be informed. I have an informed opinion. The San Francisco Chronicle, I believe it is, has run a story on the connections between the Scientologist and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. Are you aware of that story? And if you are aware of that story, I want to know whether or not
only
that
only as a reader.
Huh?
Only as a reader.
That's what I mean. That's
I
what
read
I mean.
That story,
as a reader.
Yes.
Because I'm sure you read, I don't know how many of you
read
pages
that.
You read.
Story, yes.
You remind me of a lot of, huh? How many papers you read a day?
Well, I used to read 5 regularly every day, but, you know, with now with Internet, you can, I mean, I read overseas papers. You know, I mean, I read the South African papers. I read the African papers as well. You know, on Internet, you can scan the world. So, I mean, you lose track, you know, but, you know, I, for many years, would read five papers a day, and they generally would be of different views. You know, everything from the Wall Street to the Times, of course, and.
By keeping up with you, you caused me to now know how to surf the net. Now, let you also write for The Root as well. I mean, so you're still a practicing journalist, rather. And I think that's important for us to know. You know, journalists are not people to just come around with opinions. Journalists are people who correct stories, check sources, verify facts, and come up with those kind of things. How are we going to have a robust democracy among African Americans if we don't have a robust press? Or is it possible? Some call it the third estate. Share with us your opinion on that.
No, you cannot have a robust democracy among African Americans or anyone else without a press. I mean, the whole role of the press, and I don't mean me and what I do, but rather the whole idea, you know, of a free press is that you are protected to gather information to inform the people. It's very simple. The only role, the chief primary role is to inform the American people, to gather these facts, and sometimes it's dangerous gathering these facts, as you know. As I told you before, I've been run out of 6 countries, you know, abroad, three of those countries at gunpoint, by simply trying to gather information. For what reason? To take it home and sell it on the open? No, to inform the American people, black and white, as to what's going on. And so I think that if you are going, and so those opinions and decisions that you should make, they should be informed. If you want to follow anyone you want to follow, you should at least know what the facts are. If you want, in terms of who do you vote for and what car you buy, you know, what roach powder you might take, you know, you can do whatever you want. But it is better if you make those choices with information, as opposed to just, you know, putting your finger in the air or reading Third Psalms, you know, and hoping against hope.
Purpose of really being informed. Now, we have about 12 minutes. I want to go to New York local politics. And we have another interesting situation. We have the mayor of the city of New York, city that is affectionately mine. I love it. I wish I could. New Jerseyans, I still love you all. I don't want you all to think I don't, but I love you. Intoxicated as I come into New York and get tipsy. But I want to ask you about the current mayor, Mayor de Blasio. And also, it seems that there is a connection between Mayor de Blasio, wife, press secretary, I believe a very wonderful lady, Rachel Norlander, I believe. I hope I'm correctly pronouncing her name, but I'm delightful. I've met her, talked with her. I think she's a wonderful person. But she's a former press person for Reverend Alfred C. Shopton, the president of the National Action Network. And I just want the audience to know, I'm not prejudiced against Reverend Shopton. I've known him for many years. I knew him when he was a Church of God in Christ preacher, childhood preacher. I knew him when he was reincarnated as a pastor in the Baptist Church, ordained and baptized by one of my very good friends that I look up to, the William Augustus Jones. So I don't have any brief for or against Reverend Shopton, but I just have facts. And when I'm on this program, I'm asking for facts. I was framed by a man by the name of Captain Joseph, as you probably know, and he told me all the way to get the facts. Don't come with your opinion. Come with the facts. So I wanted to ask you, is there any, I don't know. The question, I'd just like you to make a comment on that.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been increasingly, you know, I spend a lot of my time because I'm, you know, writing books and other things, and I spend a lot of my time, you know, refusing interviews. But I have recently been doing New York One because they want to talk, you know, politics and inside City Hall. So I've been paying attention to de Blasio. In fact, I've gone on a couple of times in May again with Clyde Haberman, formerly of the New York Times, and we as two veteran journalists sit around and talk about, you know, the inside City Hall, city politics, you know, and so I've been paying somewhat attention to it, you know, that have been flowing here. And just in terms of the staffing that he has, I mean, let me be very, very clear. As I said before, I don't even have a personal gripe against Reverend Shopton per se, and I certainly don't have anything against people who associate with him, you know, but I think, though, that, you know, the whole idea of influence peddling, that his power accrues from people that he associates with. So there are a lot of good people, you know, who are associated with him. I don't begrudge them. I don't think that, you know, that, you know, from that's Reverend Richardson, you know, and Waldron, there's a whole bunch of people. I think, you know, Hope Up, Gary Bird, others. I mean, that's, you know, this is a coalition. Each of these people standing on their own. I don't begrudge, you know, people who have connections. But in terms of de Blasio, I think that after 12 years of Bloomberg, four of which, in my view, were illicit, because I think that he should have been term limited as the New York did by a vote, saying that he should have a 2-4-year terms, and he rang over the city council, you know, a third term quite on his own, not unlike Papa Doc. You know, I thought he was going to be mayor for life there for a while. In fact, I wrote a column calling him Papa Doc Bloomberg. He didn't like that. But I think that after 8 years of Bloomberg, I think that de Blasio is a breath of air. Now, is that to say that that all of his policies are squaring? No, he has some huge problems. Housing, he speaks well about housing, he speaks well about education. I think that we'll see. Well, he stopped stopping frisks. He settled, for instance, he's done some good things. I mean, I think the $98 million settlement with the firemen, you know, was a good thing. I think that the Central Park jogger case settling, I think that stopping frisks. I mean, those are things that coming in the first 100 days, as it were, give you a pretty good idea that this is a breath of fresh air and a pivot. You know, it clearly is a 90-degree pivot, you know, from billionaire Bloomberg. So we'll see how thing goes. I'm sure Shopton has influence because that's what he is, and that's what he sells. That's what's on the market. He's an influence peddler.
I want to ask you another question. You, the new editor of the New York Times, the reason I bring this up, I just want you people to know your credentials. You know, African Americans, I hate to say it, we have a tendency to take each other for granted. And sometimes we just don't know what we're working with. I'm using the street expression, show me what you're working with, I think they use. I have to keep my creed because, you know, Rick Ross and his crowd is part of my constituency. So, hey, you know, we want to keep all of them honest. So, I want to ask you, yeah, an executive editor of the New York Times, did she at one time work with you or Miss Jill Edgar.
Well, the national editor. Oh, yeah. She's a good friend, and, yeah, she used to work for me on the the national editor, and I hope this doesn't embarrass her, but it's a fact. Again, so we can discuss the facts. No, Allison Mitchell, she's the national editor of the paper, and she used to, in fact, I first sent her to the, during the Nicaraguan crisis down there, and she was my Moscow correspondent. You know, she's brilliant, very, very smart woman, very, very good reporter, very, very hardworking, yeah, and a good friend, you know, Allison Mitchell, yeah. So, I mean, but there's a lot of people, you know, when we talk, like Clyde Haberman, who used to work there. We were just talking about her the other day.
I was just about him, and I, of course, I had occasion to read an article on the Reverend Alfred C. Shopton in, I believe, the Village Voice, and I called you up. I said, Les, is Wayne Barrett, is he a reputable journalist? You know, I have come across journalists, in fact, I hate to say it, one guy's gone on to his just reward that you and I both know him. He'll remain anonymous, a wonderful person. But
no, Wayne Barrett's a real deal. Wayne Barrett's a real deal. He's an investigative reporter. He works on facts, works on files, he works on checking stuff out. It's a real deal. And, you know, if you check his work on Shopton, not just on Shopton, but on other investigations, you know, he's very, very good and is very reliable and steady over the years.
And also, I think we should end it with a little humor. We don't want the people to think we're so uptight. you know, you. I read a story about you, by you rather, when you were a rookie journalist. I mean, that's that couple of years ago, and you had done covered the migrant workers, and I want you to put a reference so that one can get that story. And also, it's a classic story that anybody who works with journalists and salt should read. And that was your kind of beginning in investigative journalism.
Boy, you have a wide range there.
I think we should have some humor.
I didn't even know you were from all of this.
Laugh, I pulled that story out.
I'll run it real quick. When I first got into journalism, I came to Newsday, and I found that there were migrants working out on the east end of New York. And I found out that on the potato farms out there. And what I found is that people, Newsday had done a lot of stories, but they had not talked to the migrants. And I was, how can you do all of these stories? They were talking to the farm owners. They were talking to the Vista workers. They were talking to the medical people, the Red Cross, everybody. But they had not talked to the migrants. So I said, why haven't you spoken with the migrants? They said, well, you know, they're not very educated. They're from the South. They drink a lot. They don't hold their infinities together. You know, they were giving me all these stories. So then I checked and found out that not only that, but the farms were private. And some of these guys were armed, and they had pit bulls or German shepherds back then, and they wouldn't allow you on the profit. So you couldn't talk to them to find out what their lives were like. So what I decided to do as a journalist is to go and work on a potato farm. So I sent my wife, she didn't like it a lot, to Connecticut, where my family were, and I hitchhiked out on the East End, got a job on the migrant farm, and worked there for a week. You know, until payday to see what their lives were like. I lived in a barracks, you know, there were 14 of us in a barracks, sleeping in their clothes, working on the potato fields during the day, drinking wine from sun up to way, way after sundown. A cheap twist of wine, by the way. It used to make me ill, but I had to drink it so they wouldn't catch on to me. I had to fight, curse, swear, do everything, you know, when I was living with them. But at the end of the day, and I told them my name was Bubba, you know, and that I was from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And luckily, I said Tuscaloosa and then picked a place like Virginia, where you're from. Where in Virginia are you from?
Anyway,
I told him I was from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So at the end of the day, the crew chief got suspicious of me, so he came to me. He found a guy from Tuscaloosa who came up to me, and he walked up to me and said, is your name Bubba? I said, absolutely, my name is Bubba. He said, are you from Tuscaloosa? He said, I hear you're from Tuscaloosa. And I said, Alabama. And I said, well, yeah, I am. And this was the last day, and he said, where's Tucson Service? And I told him where it was, luckily. And then he asked me to name the radio stations in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. You know, luckily I remembered all three of them, you know, four of them, actually. That was a new black one. And then he was pressing me until he got down, and turns out he knew my uncle. And my uncle was the baddest guy in Tuscaloosa. His name was Deadwood Dick. Nobody messed with him. And I just found him, and I mentioned Deadwood to him. He said, oh, you know Deadwood? And I said, not only do I know Deadwood, but that's my uncle. That's my mother's brother. he backed off for the first time. But anyway, that story, I wrote about what it was like living in a migrant camp. You can just Google Les Payne and the migrant. In fact, that story is being taught at NYU now. New York University teaches, you know, that whole going undercover at the migrant camp. You know, so it's everything's online. That certainly is online as well.
It's a classic story. And, you know, again, not that I have to vouch for you, but that's the kind of story. And, you know, I understand you also covered, you went up, someone said personally, one reporter told me, I don't know whether I can disclose that, and covered the Tawana Brawley story yourself. You went up to Wasatches Falls.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I came out of retirement as a reporter because no one would get the story. And I went up and developed a story from her point of view, developed her boyfriend and you know, whom she had told precisely what happened. And I got information that Sharpton and the lawyers did not in that, and they were astonished to find out. And I'll just tell you one bitter thing, you know, and this was even after the Brawley case. Sharpton may be embarrassed by this, but after the Brawley case, and I had written, you know, what threat he was to, I was on Sunday Edition once, and remember when Freddy's happened? When the store in Harlem, Freddy's, was going to be burned down, they were trying to say that Sharpton was responsible for it. Remember that?
Yes, I do remember it, yes.
And what happened is that they said that was Sharpton was responsible for it. And I said on the show, I think Tony Goddard or Jim Jensen was on the set, look, Sharpton had nothing to do with that because even though he had said that white interlopers were coming into New York, those people who were responsible of Pickett and Freddy's were people, you know, these were hard left-wing radicals. And I said, these people are on the shop. There's no way they would take what he would say serious. And I said, and besides, and I said this on the air, on television, I said, Sharpton works for and is responsive to Alphonse D'Amato. All right? Alphonse D'Amato. He had nothing to do with this thing. And he called me later and thanked me for it. And also, just to show you that this stuff is not personal, after all of this was done, you know, when I think when he was running for Senate, you know, he went to the New York Times. They had an editorial board meeting. And the New York Times asked Reverend Sharpton, he said, you're always beating up on the press. You know, I think this may have been in the 2000s. He said, this is after all of this stuff. He says, you always beat it up on the press. He said, can you give us the names of people who are any good in the press? And he gave them two names of people he said that were stellar journalists that he had some confidence in. This is Reverend Sharpton. After Tawana Brawley, after, you know, me saying all of this stuff about him and news that reported all this stuff about him. And he said, who are these two people? And he said, Murray Kempton and Les Payne. And the New York Times editor was
stunned. That is a way to close the show for those of you I'm going to have to go do something for Roz Barak, who's running for the mayor. I see
all
one
right.
Other person, if you wish to ask the question, just press one on your phone. If you already have asked questions, let's see, can we get someone else in here? Yeah, I think that's a testimony to you as a journalist. I certainly came highly recommended to me by a great man, my teacher. In fact, one of the most important persons outside of the two Muhammads, that was Imam Yusuf Shah. And
he was a great man, and we certainly can close on this note. He was a great man. I respected him a lot. And I'll tell you right now, he called me. And he almost, I gave him my number at the office. We had him by the house and everything. And he called me one day and you know, gave me some information to pass on to someone. And then never forget it, I think it was a Wednesday. And the next morning, you know, his wife called me and told me that he had died that night. So he called me the night before he died.
And he called me a day before. He said,
yes.
If you see Les Payne, that's how I ended up meeting you. I knew who you were. But he said it, always be supportive and be forthcoming to him. So with those notes, dear beloved people, we thank you for listening. We thank Les Payne for being with us.
All right,
you'll
we'll be
in touch. Another day of Religion Means Life. We're going to play this over again so the public can hear it. Those of you who want to listen to it again, you can go to Blog Talk Radio, www.blogtalkradio.com/. Look, put in Religion Means Alive. Put in the date, and it will be available. Thank you, Les, and you have a wonderful day.
Imam Muhammad, thank you. We'll be in touch.
Thanks.
Bye.